What grows in the forest? Trees? Sure. Know what else grows in the forest? Our imagination, our sense of wonder, and our family bonds grow too. Because when we disconnect from this and connect with this, we reconnect with each other. The forest is closer than you think. Find a forest near you and start exploring at discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the United States Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Good evening. This is 91.5 FM WMFO Medford. The opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of station management, Tufts University Administration, or the Board of Trustees. My show runs every Friday this summer from 6 to 8 p.m. Today on the show, a very special episode of Radical with Majid Nawaz. He interviews Peter McCullough. This was recorded on July 24, 2022. Radical is on the Odyssey video website, odyse.com. And Majid Nawaz is on Twitter at Majid Nawaz, M-A-A-J-I-D-N-A-W-A-Z. This conversation lasts for 90 minutes. And now, Majid Nawaz and Peter McCullough.
Hello and welcome to Radical with me, Majid Nawaz. Today we're speaking yet again to an eminent expert in the field of COVID mandates. Now, when we do such a thing, and that is speak to somebody that we believe deserves your full attention, we usually dedicate the entire episode to that single interview. And that's what we've done again today. And the reason is you can understand, as we did with senior whistleblower Dr. Mike Yeadon, who was at one time the head for respiratory illnesses for Pfizer around the world. So clearly that's somebody that had something to say about Pfizer. As we did with Dr. Sam White, who was a practicing GP, a doctor here, a general practitioner in the United Kingdom, who the General Medical Council attempted to silence and then attempted to forcibly or through coercion have him submit to a psych evaluation because of his critique of COVID mandates, and as we've done with other interviews, such as investigative journalist Dr. Naomi Wolf. When we feel that we have a guest that deserves the room to breathe and air their views out in long form, we dedicate an entire episode to that one conversation. So joining us today is Dr. Peter McCullough. Now, you're about to hear just precisely who this man is, but in short summary, because you're going to hear it in a lot more detail, I'll tell you that you're about to listen to the most published physician in his field in history. You heard that correctly. Dr. Peter McCullough says it himself. He is the most published physician in his field in history. And he has some very serious concerns that he's raised about COVID mandates, about the injections that were mandated upon entire populations across the West, and indeed a focus on early treatment protocols, the McCullough protocol, and what that treatment should entail. Now, the very least you could say about somebody such as Dr. Peter McCullough is that he deserves a platform to speak. That's the very least you could say. If you were being fair, you'd say he's kind of a medical authority and should be taken seriously. The problem here is, and I'm sure you've seen enough of this by now, that even the very least hasn't been granted by our mainstream corporatist media. The very least, and that is that he should be given a platform to air his views, has been denied to him. He's had professorships withdrawn. He's had jobs terminated simply because, with his medical and professional opinion, he's been advocating for early treatment when it comes to COVID-19. Now, the problem here, of course, is self-evident. But looking at it from an Orwellian perspective, it's also very interesting to me, because in times such as these, where good is bad and bad is good, where people that should be applauded are mocked and have their character assassinated, and where those that should be in jail are celebrated as heroes and leaders, in times such as these, and why I use the word Orwellian, is that it's perfectly normal for the world to appear upside down. And that's why in 1984, Orwell talks about war being peace, freedom being slavery. Those words taking their opposite meaning because power has that ability to turn our world upside down. So the eminent experts that we should be listening to are figures who have their characters assassinated, and those who I believe quite probably deserve to be in jail over very and incredibly serious historical war crimes are the ones being hailed in corporatist media as the heroes. And Dr. Peter McCullough is one such man that it would be fair to say would be somebody, when you hear that phrase, listen to the experts. As I say, the very least we should do is listen to somebody like him and what he has to say. Instead, of course, he's being rubbished and ridiculed. So what do we do in a situation like this? Well, we can only continue to push with the facts, continue to speak, and continue to reveal what is before us in terms of evidence, in the hope that as many of you as possible, episode after episode, conversation after conversation, are armed with more and more information so that those in your immediate vicinity, whether it be family or friends or loved ones, slowly begin to wake up to precisely what's been happening to us over the last few years. And what has been happening, I'll tell you clearly what I think, has been a full-on assault on our human dignity to serve nefarious ends, whether those ends be profit or power. We are under attack. We as human beings are under attack by a complex, a pharmaceutical complex that is so powerful and so wealthy that it can afford, for example, Pfizer, it can afford to face the largest criminal fine in history, whether that be Pfizer or GlaxoSmithKline, both large pharmaceutical companies, and yet still turn billions of profits over every year. Now, that level of power that you see led to the fact that every single English-speaking nation, they're called the Five Eyes Nations, New Zealand, Canada, Australia, America, and the United Kingdom, coupled with European nations, at the same time, implemented the same misguided policy by coercion against their population, against a population that all believe in liberty. That tells you just how powerful this and deeply rooted this corruption has gone, and just how upside down this world is. So what I'd like to do is, when speaking to Dr. McCullough, because of who he is spend a lot of time listening to his answers and mulling over what he has to say. And then, of course, it becomes our responsibility to spread what we learn from this conversation to others. So without further ado, here is Dr. Peter McCullough. Welcome, Peter, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, before we get to the meat of why we wanted to speak to you on Radical, and thank you again for making the time, I think it's important to first establish for our viewers exactly who Peter McCullough is and what is your background medically and also in terms of published research.
Well, thanks so much for having me on the program. I have to admit, I'm nervous. I put on my best suit, as I was when I went on the Joe Rogan Experience. I went down to his studio in Austin, as you did, and wore a suit and tie and showed up with all the medical data I could on slides to make sure I was completely accurate, as I will today. I'm a practicing internist and cardiologist in Dallas, Texas. I'm at a large academic medical center, and I've, in my fourth decade of medical practice, I'm continuously certified by the American Board of Internal Medicine in both internal medicine and cardiovascular diseases. Additionally, I'm trained in epidemiology at the University of Michigan, and I've used the epidemiological skills and capabilities through my entire career. I've had a focus on the interface between heart and kidney disease up until the pandemic. And in that area, I have over 600 publications in the peer-reviewed medical literature. That's cited in PubMed, well over 1,000 overall communications. And in Google Scholar, I have an H index that's over 100. That means that the average paper I publish is read more than 100 times. And, of interest, I'm the most published cardiologist in the history of nephrology. I have one of the top 100 most cited papers in the history of the field of nephrology, as I worked with nephrologists to make some important discoveries on how the heart and kidneys interact with one another. I went to undergraduate at Baylor University in Texas, which is the oldest university in Texas. It was founded during the time when Texas was its own country, 10 years of the Republic of Texas. Went on to University of Texas Southwestern Medical School in Dallas, finished top of my class, Alpha Omega Alpha, and went on to the University of Washington in Seattle and trained in medicine. I had 3 years of public service. as a rural practitioner, and then in that third year received master's in public health at University of Michigan, went on and trained in cardiology at what's now the Oakland University William Beaumont School of Medicine, where the very first paper I ever published was in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it dealt with a new technique we were developing called primary angioplasty for acute myocardial infarction, which became the worldwide standard. Since that time, I've had leadership positions in medicine, and I've had a wonderful career. I've traveled the world. I was a guest lecturer in two divisions at Harvard. In 2018, I've lectured before the European Medicine Agencies, the FDA, the Congressional Oversight Panel for the FDA. I've been on or chaired 24 data safety monitoring boards and consider myself an expert on data safety. And the reason why I'm telling you all that is because I have a considerable experience with publications and data. It means I've read a lot of papers and I can interpret a lot of information. And so when the pandemic hit, I took those skills and that background, and I applied all of my research and scholarship towards the pandemic.
Well, I think it's fair to say that makes you reasonably qualified to have this conversation with us. So thank you for joining us. Now, I've noticed there's a lot of certificates behind your wall. Before I get to those, I will remark, of course, here in London, we still have that original Texas embassy that people can visit. It's preserved, the building, with a nice plaque outside. And, you know, it states that this used to be the Independent Republic of Texas Embassy to London. It's a wonderful building to see, and some great history there. But talk to us a bit about all these certificates behind you and what they represent.
Well, I mentioned the various training steps that a doctor goes through from the time I graduated from high school at age 17 to the time I was fully trained and developed as a cardiologist. That took 17 years. A lot of people don't realize what a long journey it is. It's been said that about 25 peer-reviewed publications would make full professor of medicine. It certainly would at any of the UK schools. And I can tell you, at approaching 700 peer-reviewed papers, I would more than qualify to be a professor. And let me state that there is a term that's come out in this whole media commentary, physician media commentary experience on the pandemic. And the term was actually, I think, first in an interview I had with Tucker Carlson. And the term was medical authority. And what Tucker said is, listen, you should listen to this doctor. He has authority. And authority is not a legal or legislative authority. It's a scientific authority to render an opinion. And to have that opinion listened to and respected. And from the very beginning, I've had scientific authority. And I mentioned I directed all my efforts towards the pandemic. I have now 57 papers in the peer-reviewed literature on the pandemic, either as a primary author or in an author block. I was in a large consortium with Harvard and was called the Stop COVID-19 Investigative Group. But I've published the two seminal papers outlining how doctors can treat the illness to prevent hospitalization and death, and then published two of the outcomes papers demonstrating that the technique of treating patients early with what's called the sequence multi-drug approach results in a substantial reduction in hospitalization and death. And so it's called the McCullough Protocol. It's patent pending, and it's probably the most gratifying thing I've done in my career. It's been accredited with the approach of treating people early, have been credited with sparing tens of millions of hospitalizations worldwide and saving millions of lives. It's enormously gratifying to work in this area.
These certificates behind you, I imagine, represent all of those various qualifications and commendations you've achieved in your career. Now, what's happened, Peter, before we get to the substance of your critique on COVID measures? And we will get to that for the bulk of this conversation. But tell me very quickly, with the expertise that you've just outlined and with the authority with which you speak, what's happened when you have spoken? Have you faced people that perhaps don't have that level of expertise criticizing you for wading into this debate? Have any of those commendations or titles that you have just generously listed for us come under challenge or threat because of your views or your interventions into the COVID debate? Have you faced a smear on your character. Talk to us a bit about that, because we hear often listen to the experts. And in my experience, whether it be, and you've referenced my appearance on Rogan, whether it be what I touch on, which is a lot of the political and geopolitical ramifications of some of these measures, people don't listen to those who actually they should be listening to. So have you faced any of that?
You know, I credit your Rogan interview, which I watched carefully. Your Rogan interview sets all records for Joe Rogan's shocked facial expressions. It should be analyzed for that. I know the transcript comes out on Rogan, but there should be one about his facial expressions, jaw-dropping, eye-popping, Majid Nawaz reactions. It really was tremendous. But
somebody's going to make that into a meme now. You watch.
No, it really was terrific. But I was shocked when I was asked, on media appearances, and it's common. And listen, I'm no stranger to the media. I was on C-SPAN, which is the government channel, for over 7 hours for a Congressional Oversight Panel FDA presentation in 2007. So I'm not a stranger to the media, but I'm a frequent media commentator on Fox and Newsmax and OAN and Victory Channel. I've been on ABC, I've been on most of the major stations. I was shocked when a few days later, I'd find out on the internet that there was an anonymous, presumably uncredentialed fact checker would make false counterclaims against some of my statements. And my statements are so carefully referenced, whether I'm referencing my own work or the work of others. I'm usually able to cite the first author, the year, sometimes the journal of publication. I do the best I can as I'm looking at the camera, as I'm doing right now. And in fact, the fact-checking came from the strangest places. So on March 10th, 2021, under oath, I testified in the Texas Senate. And under oath means the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And it's to the best of one's ability, because I'm in before a Senate panel. I am trying to answer the questions the best I can, referencing the material.
And does that carry criminal liability if you're not telling the truth? Is it that kind of oath?
Well, I guess one could say it's a threat of perjury if one intentionally lied. But, I was giving, for instance, I was challenged on a calculation of herd immunity at the time, but which I used CDC formulae. And I stated that. I mean, these were very objective things. I was fact-checked by Rémy Bonnet, who is a French journalist. So why would someone in France care about what a Texas doctor is stating regarding Texas statistics in the Texas Senate? These types of fact-checking, questioning from uncredentialed, this is someone who's uncredentialed. He's a reporter. He doesn't have 17 years of credentials. I've also shockingly faced vitriol and defamation when I testified in the U.S. Senate on November 19th, 2020. Senator Ron Johnson was the majority leader of the Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. Gary Peters was the minority chairman. I was one of three majority witnesses. I was the lead witness. This is a very serious, I want people to understand, this is a very serious professional activity to testify in the U.S. Senate or in a congressional oversight panel. So my statements were prepared. They were prepared ahead of time. They were submitted to the Senate. They were checked. They were accepted. I had a governmental the biography that was submitted. There's rigor to this. Do you know that the minority witness, who is Ashish Jha, who's the current White House coordinator, former dean at the Brown School of Public Health, someone who over the course of the inquiry admitted he had never seen an examined or treated a COVID patient. And, I had treated at that time many hundreds of patients, and I had published the approach on how to do this. Here a minority witness, and as someone who is a junior to me in academia, said that, do you know the next day he had already pre-prepared and published in a major newspaper, it was either New York Times or Wall Street Journal, an op-ed called Snake Oil Salesman of the Senate. to try to degrade myself, Harvey Risch, George Fried, who had treated the most patients, and Senator Ron Johnson. And we were just advocating the use of fully FDA-approved, generically available drugs that had supportive evidence in the literature and acceptable safety.
And Peter, this person wasn't even medically qualified.
Well, you know, he had never treated a patient. So for him to make such a defamatory claim, you know, I had never faced that in my career. Since that time, it has been an unbelievable ride. You know, in January of 2021, after all this celebrity in terms of the major media, I had received a large grant to my organization. I oriented my research team on pandemic projects. I had published these breakthrough papers that were, you know, most downloaded papers in those journals, and testified in the U.S. Senate in late 2020. In January of 2021, I was walked into the room by two administrators, one of whom I'd never met before. And they said, turn in your badge. You're done. Your job is done. I said, wait a minute. Wow. I have a contract. I'm coming up for renewal. You know, a non-renewal, there's a due process here. There must be a board vote.
Which organization was this, Peter? Which institution?
It's an institution that I can't name. It's the largest health system in Texas and a very prestigious academic medical center. And I can't name them because what's happened is not only without due process was my contract not renewed. As a part of that, I won a settlement on a settlement agreement. And now, 6 months later, now I'm under a seven-figure lawsuit from them. And the lawsuit alleges that I've dragged their name into the media. That's the reason why the name is not going to come up in this interview, because I've never dragged their name into the media. Their lawsuit has gone nowhere. It's gone into mediation, and the response times back and forth have really lengthened without any, you know, major impetus on either side to fundamentally end it. I've done everything I've can. I've filed briefs for motion to dismiss, according to what's called SLAP or strategic lawsuit, against my public participation in a topic of importance. And the motion is not even heard by the judge. It's almost as if there's a complete corruption across the board. But that lawsuit has been used to discredit me in social media. And then after that, a whole sequence of events. You know, I transferred my practice from one employer to another in the same medical center. I see, you know, way more patients than I used to. I'm absolutely overwhelmed with patients coming from all over the nation who want to see me. I've brought more business and more goodwill to the organization, yet they won't drop the lawsuit. But I've been stripped of two professorships at local universities. I was full professor of medicine. Now, these were voluntary positions, but there was no faculty senate, no discussion of why this was happening, no courtesy phone call. I was the longstanding editor or a co-editor of Reviews in Cardiovascular Medicine, a major journal. I was stripped of that editorship and summarily dismissed by email. I was stripped of editorship of Cardiorenal Medicine, another journal. This is a Swiss journal.
Peter, you said by email. They didn't even call you.
No phone call, no call by the deputy editor. No editorial board meeting. These came by email. Everything I'm describing came by email or by certified mail. And I can tell you, these were longstanding positions. Both those journals enjoyed incredible increases in impact factor as I worked dutifully in my roles with those two journals, very prestigious. And it didn't stop there. I was stripped of all my National Institutes of Health committee positions, from American College of Cardiology writing group positions. It just happened. I was taken off teaching services without any discussion, without any phone call of, you know, you have a different point of view. Let's discuss this. What have you. These were basically a silent, surgical types of events that happened. And many of them actually involved my friends. So on the certified letters were some professional friends where they, you know, a letter comes in, you are hereby stripped of this position, signed my friend. And I have to tell you, there are dozens and dozens of these that happen. So what's behind me are my certificates either my training certificates or my degrees. Maybe that's next. And in fact, on May 26th, I received a letter from the American Board of Internal Medicine, which provides the board certification status for both my internal medicine and cardiology. I electively continuously certify internal medicine, also in cardiovascular disease. I have a perfect track record. In fact, for the examinations, the American Board of Internal Medicine probably relies on many of the concepts and medical knowledge that I've generated in the course of my career. The letter says that I am now subject to a disciplinary hearing and that I could incur professional reprisal for this. And they've gone through public statements, many of which I've made under oath, and said that those statements in this letter from the American Board, it says, widely reported, disseminated public statements about the purported dangers of or lack of justification for COVID-19 vaccines. So the American Board of Internal Medicine, clearly interested in emergency authorized use, investigational, genetic COVID-19 vaccines and statements which could have led to someone not being encouraged or induced into taking one of these. And they picked statements in my Texas Senate testimony. They picked ones I've made on Fox News. And so I generated a 20-page response letter with citations for every single statement and asked them to dismiss this review. They did not. Senator Ron Johnson wrote Richard Barron a letter from the U.S. Senate, I think it's 39th senatorial letter from his committee on the pandemics, asking them to meet with him and myself and others, have the American Board come out and let's discuss the issues of concern. No response from Richard Barron. In fact, he tweeted 2 days later that he's joining forces with the American Medical Association and intensifying the hunt on COVID-19 misinformation.
Wow. I mean, look, what we've just heard there, I think it's fair to say there has been a character assassination on the most published physician in his field, the most published physician in history in his field, for taking a stand on his own expertise. I mean, it sounds to me like there's a concerted effort to silence your voice, which doesn't surprise me. Nevertheless, it's worthy for viewers to hear because it's a similar story we've heard from Dr. Sam White here in the UK, who the General Medical Council of the UK tried to gag, and they not only ordered him that he was no longer allowed to speak about these kinds of topics, but also that he wasn't allowed to post about them on social media. And believe it or not, Dr. McCullough, they said that he needs to submit himself for a psych evaluation, which he refused to do. And he took them to court and he won the case. And he's on a couple of interviews ago. If you have a bit of time, have a look, Dr. Sam White. It reminds me very much of his story because he took a similar stance. Now, what I'd like to do after having heard all of that is what were the topics? I know because COVID and its mandates, there are a range of topics, all of which actually have been shut down. And they are, whether that be ivermectin, criticizing lockdowns, questioning the efficacy of the vaccines, questioning the motives of the politicians involved in this and the political side. In your case, which particular themes within the overall topic of COVID and its mandates were you touching on, or are you still touching upon, that you believe has caused this kind of backlash from the powers that be who seek to silence you?
Well, let me just first say, I know Sam White. I've interviewed him for the McCullough Report, and which is a weekly radio show and podcast, and I provided expert reports and statements of support for his legal case. So glad he won, and I feel absolutely wonderful as a senior doctor supporting a junior, wonderful, talented doctor the UK really needs. You know, where I have initially faced the most adversity has to do with the treatment of COVID-19, that is helping people avoid hospitalization and death. And I tell the story in this book, Courage to Face COVID-19, Preventing Hospitalizations and Deaths, while battling the biopharmaceutical complex. I wrote it with John Leek. This is a narrative. It's a true story. So it's written. It's the only COVID book that's written in the format of a story. And it's number one on Amazon in viral diseases, communicable diseases, and true crime. It's been out about 60 days now. And we tell the story of what happened. And, you know, I had the expectation that discoveries on treatment on an illness that was resulting in hospitalization and death, that these discoveries of a treatment were going to be met with great excitement and with great amplification. Instead, they were met with resistance and suppression and of censorship. And I was stunned. Since when would we censor an advancement in heart disease or cancer? So along the way, what we describe is a complete and total suppression of any form of treatment, whether it's anything from a nasal oral mouthwash to generic available medications, over-the-counter nutraceuticals and supplements, even our emergency use authorized high-tech treatments that should be as embraced. They're as high-tech as vaccines are. They were all intentionally suppressed. And in a breakout interview, I told Tucker Carlson, I said, Tucker, I think this is intentional. Those who are suppressing any information to Americans or people in the world on treatment are the same people who are in an unbridled fashion supporting the vaccines. I think it's intentional to promote fear, suffering, hospitalization, and death. I think it's intentional in order to prepare the population to accept mass vaccination on a regular basis.
This is 91.5 FM WMFO Medford. You're listening to Majid Nawaz on his show Radical on the website odyssey.com, O-D-Y-S-E-E, talking to Peter McCullough. There is 1 hour remaining in this conversation. Now back to the show.
So your view is that there is more than just the market incentive from the direction of big pharmaceutical companies that produce these vaccines to squash any alternative treatment. Your view is that beyond the money, it's to customize the population to these regular boosters that sometimes are every 4 months, every 6 months, whatever that pattern is. You think that these pharmaceuticals want a bit like a coffee loyalty scheme where you get the stamps and you get buy six coffees and you get your seventh free. They want us hooked into injections as a force of habit for every single citizen ad infinitum. Is that what you're saying, the reason for why your alternative treatments were suppressed?
Right. It's following the plan of what's called CEPI, the Center for Epidemic Preparedness and Innovation, that came together in 2017. It's in our book by the Gates Foundation, the World Economic Forum, and the Wellcome Trust. And, you know, the CEPI said there will be pandemics and they will be business opportunities for vaccine development. It was only about vaccine development, no mention of treatment whatsoever. So it's following there is a willful blindness to treatment, and it's worldwide. You know, most governments just simply are government agencies, haven't had any review of treatments. They haven't had any public service announcements. Every single medical society that was previously opining in any way has been absolutely oblivious to treatment. Now, organizations did come forward. The first one was the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, an older group. I had joined the group during the pandemic. You know, they're chartered in every state in America. With my breakthrough paper at American Journal of Medicine in August 7th of 2021, shortly after that, we wrote a home treatment guide of what to do when someone gets COVID at home. Then American Frontline Doctors came on board, Frontline Critical Care Network, Truth for Health Organization. Fortunately, we had enough telemedicine services and private doctors that stepped forward. You know, when I testified in the U.S. Senate November 19th of 2020, I told America, I said, listen, we're not going to like what we see around Christmas time. There's going to be people in body bags. It's going to be horrific unless we start treating the illness. But fortunately, early treatment kicked in. We did hit our peak of hospitalization in January of 2021, and it came down rapidly after that. And I can tell you, after January 2021, the emergency was over in the United States. Remember, the emergency is really what doctors declare based on hospital capacity. When our hospitals become overrun, that is a state of emergency. Otherwise, there was no state of emergency. And we got out of that situation based on early treatment in January of 2021. So these were important developments, but I faced censorship and reprisal. It was clear I had lost my job, not because of the vaccines. That was before, you know, we had had any safety data come out on the vaccines. I lost my job because I treated patients. I spared hospitalizations and I saved lives.
Now, talking of early treatment, before we get to vaccines and your views on those, what imagine you're talking to a case study patient that has Omicron or any other strand that may come or has come. What is this early treatment you're describing? In your professional view, what should somebody do early on to make sure they address this so they don't end up in hospital?
Well, first,
and likewise, I imagine that's what you got into trouble for saying. So we'd love to continue getting you into more trouble by hearing it again.
Well, let me say, I just testified in the Texas Senate on June 27th, 2022, and I made it clear. Legally, doctors have a duty to treat, a duty to treat. And the community standard of care may be as few as a single doctor who's willing to treat the illness. So what I'm saying is not something that would ever or should ever get anyone into trouble. And in fact, if I'm in trouble, the people coming after me are in really big trouble because I've created a community standard of care. Community standard of care is not defined by government guidelines, government agencies, by hospitals or health systems. They're defined by doctors. It's very important. Doctors like myself, Sam White, other heroes that the world knows now. But the first step in treatment is risk stratification. We learned early the illness was very different for a 10-year-old child compared to an 80-year-old senior citizen. Very different. So risk stratification based on age, medical problems, obesity, diabetes, heart and lung disease, kidney disease, cancer, and that risk stratification really determines who needs treatment. And there have been hundreds and hundreds of studies now on treatment. And in general, it's about 25% of the adult population, very small a number of the pediatric population, maybe children with cystic fibrosis, congenital heart or lung disease, children who are already on a ventilator, for instance, chronically would need treatment. So risk stratification is the first step. And in general, people over age 50 with medical problems, they have a risk of hospitalization or death throughout the pandemic. It's become less with Omicron, but that risk exceeded 1%. And so we've always thought greater than 1% was enough to do something. When it's less than 1%, it clearly can be stylized. Now, what should people do? You know, the protocol said first thing is open the windows, get fresh air, ventilate, get outside as much as possible, start to reduce the re-inoculation. Don't wear a mask unless one was to come face to face with someone else. Otherwise, breathe fresh air. The next step was to begin virucidal nasal washes and oral gargles. This is very, very important. And as the pandemic wore on, the virus became more and more contagious, but less invasive. And with Omicron, it was replicating 70 times faster than Delta, but not invading the body to nearly the same extent. That meant the place of attack was the sinuses. We had less of a systemic opportunity. So we've learned through 12 clinical studies, 3 large randomized trials, beyond a shadow of a doubt, dilute povidone iodine not only kills SARS-CoV-2, but it markedly improves outcomes. In a paper by Chowdhury and colleagues from Bangladesh, 606 patients randomized to dilute povidone iodine, nasal washes and gargles, even eye drops versus a matching control, demonstrated, you know, over an 80% reduction in PCR positivity by day 3. So this meant people are less contagious if they're actually killing the virus in the nose and the mouth. It makes a lot of sense. You know, the reduced need for mechanical ventilation, respiratory support, reduced hospitalization and death. That's just with a locally applied, very inexpensive approach. Now, we can use dilute hydrogen peroxide. Other products have come along, including colloidal silver, various forms of nitric oxide. There have been a lot of innovations in the nasal oral field. And I can tell you the manufacturers of these products have received disciplinary letters from the FDA and the Federal Trade Commission. They've been hit hard on their attempts to try to help patients. I mean, this is stunning. It's all in our book. But I can tell you that we would start with that approach. Very simply, people want to know what's the recipe for povidone iodine. It's half a teaspoon in 1.5 ounces of water. So that would be a London, UK shot glass. So half a teaspoon of 10% povidone iodine in a shot glass of water, pinch of salt, squirt it up the nose, sniff it back, and spit it out. It's got to go all the way around and on both sides. Do it twice. Gargle with the rest. That's a thorough nasal oral wash. And we do it twice a day for prevention once exposed to a COVID patient. And then every 4 hours when acutely sick, it makes a huge difference. And you know, the best thing I've learned about this is that it works for the common cold and it works for other viral illnesses. So now I never travel without a dilute povidone iodine nasal spray. It's the best thing I've ever learned because I feel a little viral. I get to the hotel room, I do it right away and can head off a cold before it happens. If one cannot tolerate iodine or has allergies, they can use dilute hydrogen peroxide, you know, typical household 3% hydrogen peroxide. Just use 3/4 of a teaspoon, 1.5 ounces, again, a shot glass of water, pinch of salt, same procedure. So that is step one. We have after that in the McCullough protocol, and we'll, you know, you'll be able to view the graphic here on the final program, what's called the OTC, over-the-counter bundle. And the over-the-counter bundle is nutraceuticals and supplements that have supportive data. They're not curative. Supportive data are thought to be helpful. And so that would include zinc 50 milligrams a day, which works to inhibit the polymerase of the enzyme, vitamin C 3,000 milligrams a day, vitamin D, which has a very special relationship to COVID-19, very positive nutraceutical. We recommend temporarily 20,000 units of vitamin D3 a day for 5 days and back down to usual 5,000 units a day. Quercetin, 500 milligrams twice a day. Vitamin C, 3,000 milligrams a day. And then lastly, an over-the-counter drug that we have in the United States, and I think it could be over-the-counter in the UK, it's called famotidine or Pepcid. And that's given at 4 times the daily dose at 80 milligrams a day. All this has supportive literature. In the United States, beyond that, high-risk patients, we use monoclonal antibodies, and we've been through a series of them. They have been blocked, and they've been, in a sense, censored, and it's been very difficult to use monoclonal antibodies. Despite our U.S. government pre-purchasing many hundreds of millions of doses, it's been very hard to administer this very effective therapy. By the way, monoclonal antibodies, safe and effective. Joe Rogan had received the McCullough protocol. So did famous quarterback Aaron Rodgers. They talked about it. It does include monoclonal antibodies. By the way, monoclonal antibodies is the most frequent term Joe and I talked about in our transcripts since he had received them. The current one we use is called Bebtelovimab by Lilly. It's a 2cc injection. Very safe, very effective. And we use it in high-risk individuals, seniors. It should be free of charge since the U.S. has pre-purchased these. Beyond that, if they don't receive monoclonal antibodies, the next box down is oral antivirals. In the first year of the pandemic, we relied on hydroxychloroquine. Turns out the overall effect of hydroxychloroquine in about 300 supportive studies is about a 25% benefit. Ivermectin, supported by about 65 studies, over 30 randomized trials, bigger effect, about a 55% effect, impact, favorable impact on the illness. Now we have Paxlovid shown in what's called the EPIC-HR study, showing a benefit, about 80% reductions in hospitalization and death, but problems with Paxlovid. The CDC has put out a health advisory on Paxlovid May 24th of 2022, that there's indeed Paxlovid rebound, that it doesn't fully handle the virus itself. And then we can use molnupiravir. It's a Merck product, which is a form of a polymerase inhibitor. We add azithromycin or doxycycline largely to cover atypical organisms that can be a super infection. And the group from Taiwan has shown that that's the case. And we use those. And then we use aspirin, 325 milligrams, and everyone extend that to 90 days. We use inhaled budesonide, shown in 3 randomized trials. Great UK trial, Stoic trial, showed benefit of budesonide and inhaled steroid. oral steroids, prednisone, then to a lesser extent, dexamethasone or hydrocortisone. And then in a colchicine supported by the largest prospective randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial called the Col-Corona trial, colchicine, a common anti-inflammatory used in gout, that's used in the program. And then in very high-risk, bed-bound people, seniors in wheelchairs, et cetera, we use anticoagulants like low molecular weight heparin or oral anticoagulants. Now, that's a lot of drugs, and I don't expect anyone to remember that. It's called the McCullough Protocol, but we typically stylize it 4 to 6 drugs for a patient to get through a high risk. Now, this is important because what's on the line here is being hospitalized or going on a mechanical ventilator or dying. So patients are willing to go through this. And what I've learned is no single drug is necessary nor sufficient. And that groups from South America and South Africa do this with no antiviral. So no ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine is needed, but treatment is needed. And conversely, I've reviewed all the papers on hospitalization and death. And I can tell you every single case of hospitalization and death is a product of inadequate or no early treatment.
Now that's fascinating. And thank you for the exhausting list. And no doubt a lot of these details are mentioned in the book as well that you've just published. Out of all of those drugs that you've named, the one that sparked the most controversy and perhaps the most attack against those that suggested it, and know that Joe mentioned it as well, is ivermectin. Now, you've cited ivermectin, and you said as an antiviral, you said that it has over 60 supporting studies. So what is the story behind why it keeps being attacked? I was recently in New York, Peter, and I was invited there to speak about censorship and big tech and these sorts of views being silenced. As you know, that's something which has happened to me, and I've been a very strong advocate for free speech for a long time. And I mentioned people being silenced for having these views. And once again, and this is only I'm talking a couple of weeks ago, once again, annoyingly, ivermectin was dismissively referred to as horse paste by my adversary on the panel. And it is incredibly frustrating because, you know, I obviously professionally speak to people like you, Dr. Sam White, and others that are qualified to have these conversations. This person, by the way, wasn't a doctor, full stop. And yet they come up against those that they know have better qualifications in the subject matter than they do, and they are merely talking heads on the subject, and yet continue to pejoratively dismiss ivermectin as horse paste. And I invite your comment, because you raised it, I invite your comment on that.
I'm glad you brought it up. You know, uniquely, I've treated many hundreds of patients. I even treated the most number of patients. I think that credit would go to George Fried, Brian Tyson in California, or Dr. Sankaran Chetty in South Africa. But I can tell you, out of all the doctors in the world, I'm nearly certain I've used the widest range of drugs. I don't think there's a single doctor who can match me. I've used them all. I've used ivermectin. I've used, because it's the McCullough Protocol, I use them all. I use molnupiravir. I've used Paxlovid. Out of all the drugs that I've used, I can tell you clinically, the most dynamic and most rapidly acting drug is ivermectin. And that's the reason why ivermectin gets so much commentary. People take ivermectin appropriately dosed at 600 micrograms per kilogram in this acute viral phase, and they get nearly immediate relief. And I've seen it firsthand in my patients. You know, I examine COVID patients. You know, many doctors have actually never listened to the lungs of a COVID patient. No one from the White House Task Force, the CDC or NIH who's ever been on TV, or the MHRA or the TGA in Australia, has actually never, ever seen and examined a COVID patient. I have, and I've watched and I've listened to the rapid resolution of the pulmonary symptoms with and the pulmonary findings with ivermectin. The reason why ivermectin gets so much press is that it works in three ways. It's the only product that antagonizes the dangerous spike protein. Remember, the spike protein is the part of the virus that was engineered in the biosecurity lab in Wuhan, China. And there are careful papers published in the literature on how they engineered the spike protein. Ivermectin is the only thing that antagonizes the spike protein. It also blocks nuclear entry of the virus into the cell. And lastly, changes various intracellular inflammatory mediators called kinases. So ivermectin is very dynamic. Ivermectin clearly has the best population data. So, for instance, an ecological analysis, you know, hospitals in Mexico, you know, stacked with COVID patients, clear out when they start an ivermectin program. Same thing happened in South America. Same thing happened in India. That's the reason why ivermectin gets such a note. It's actually considered a WHO essential medicine. Nobel Prize has been awarded for its use. It was discovered in Japan. We have a lot in our book about the story of ivermectin. It's interesting. Two of the most dynamic products are natural products derived from nature, ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine. I think that's pretty interesting. But importantly, ivermectin has an important human uses. It was responsible for handling the scourge of river blindness, but it also has veterinary uses. And so for the US FDA, the NIH, and then on one evening, virtually every single talk host, a talk show host in the United States, to refer to ivermectin as horse paste. That's actually what my co-author John Lee calls crude propaganda. That is very intentional, crude propaganda. The message is coming from some office. You know, when Hitler was running the Nazi regime, he actually had an office of propaganda. We wonder, where is the office of COVID propaganda? Who emanates a message like that? Remember, that message would actually confuse patients. Patients are seeking life-saving treatment, and they could be confused that it's only veterinary products. So this intentional propaganda or misinformation, I think it's going to come at a heavy cost for those who have ever said those words.
I mean, you mentioned Hitler's propaganda unit. Of course, we recall that President Biden attempted to set up a disinformation czar to police precisely these sorts of conversations. It didn't get very far. And before the disinformation czar even was able to take the office, they disbanded the idea due to fierce backlash because people made precisely these sorts of comparisons. Now, we've spoken of early treatment, and I thank you for listing all that out extensively. I think it's going to be fascinating for our viewers to look at all of this and clearly have the confidence as well that it's coming from somebody that has the ability to, you know, look into this properly for them. Moving from early treatment to what is being pushed upon us by the state. Now, I want to raise vaccines. Let's call them vaccines in quotation marks, because whether they're called vaccines or whether they're called gene therapies, injections that Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, and in the early days, AstraZeneca had developed, that in a strange phenomenon, every single European, British, and Five Eyes nations, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, US, government and state were pushing at the same time in a way that was, I'd describe as coercion. We were told if we didn't take them, we'd lose our jobs. Some of us lost our jobs for challenging that. Now, looking at those particular treatments, whether it's about efficacy, whether it's about any side effects, do you have any concerns around these injections? And if so, if you could elaborate there as well for us.
Sure. I think everyone worldwide has concerns on all the products. So I think what we'll do is we'll restrict my comments to the genetic products. So people would know them as Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, and AstraZeneca. Pfizer and Moderna are called messenger RNA products. Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca are called adenoviral DNA products. Now, in total, there's about 16 vaccines that are in development or available. There's other forms out there, but we'll just, in order to keep it manageable. Let me say that the vaccines, the idea for the vaccines is not new. So with SARS-CoV-1, the original SARS virus in 2003, and then all the research grants that are all publicly available through the National Institutes of Health, was working with the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and the Eco Health Alliance, Gavi, Gates Foundation, and all the way to the biosecurity lab in Wuhan, China, that the idea of having a vaccine against the spike protein is an old idea. It's in the research grants. It's in the development. You can actually just read the scientific papers. That's my domain, is the published scientific literature. I don't speculate at all. It's all there. This is summarized in a book, a nonfiction book that has over 1,100 citations in it. It's by Peter Bregan, and it's called COVID-19 and the Global Predators, We Are the Prey. I wrote one of the introductions for it. So if anybody needs an exact citation, go to Bregan, and he's got them. So the idea is an old idea. that if one actually engineered a protein, so for instance, engineering the spike protein, that if you want, if we engineered the spike protein, that one could engineer a vaccine that could develop antibodies against that engineered protein. So this was done in the context of the lab in Wuhan, China. Again, research grants laying this out, published papers laying this out, that that one could, if we knew the genetic code of what we wanted to use, we could actually implant the genetic code in messenger RNA or in adenoviral DNA and then force human cells to produce the antigen and then form antibodies against it. So the idea is old, but its application is new. And so the idea was when there was the threat. So SARS-CoV-2, the virus, in a paper by Farkas and colleagues, published in the journal Military Medicine, and then in two papers by Yan and colleagues in the preprint service system, SARS-CoV-2 is academically classified as a bioweapon. This is very important. It's a weapon of bioterrorism, and academically it's classified that way. And so when there's a bioweapon or an instrument of bioterrorism, then there is the idea of developing a countermeasure. The countermeasure would be the vaccine.
Before you continue, Peter, I just want you to elaborate on that. You're saying academics have qualified SARS as a bioweapon. Does that have any political or legal consequences?
This is 91.5 FM WMFO Medford. You're listening to Majid Nawaz talking to Peter McCullough on the show Radical, found on odyssey.com, O-D-Y-S-E-E. There's 30 minutes remaining in this conversation. Now back to the show.
No, it clearly has political and legal consequences, and one can review the senatorial sets of testimony that that Rand Paul has had on our National Allergy Immunology Director about NIH funding of Ralph Barrick of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And Peter Daszak, who's an intermediary through the EcoHealth Alliance, and how they helped, and actually the work was done in the lab in Wuhan, China. This is very important. This is very important that this is a collaboration to engineer SARS-CoV-2 to become more invasive and to be lethal in humans. And in order to do that, they had to create mouse models that had human ACE2 receptors and then infect the mice and see what happened. All these experiments are published. These are published in the peer-reviewed literature. This isn't controversy or conspiracy. This is published. And then the determination of SARS-CoV-2 being a bioweapon, that was done by, it's not my opinion, that was done by Farkas and colleagues. That's published in Military Medicine. It's available on PubMed. One can review that, where they apply dozens of criteria of does it meet criteria as a bioweapon, and then the countermeasure obviously being the vaccine, and then two papers by Yan in the preprint service system, and she's a Chinese scientist. So I can tell you that with this backdrop, the idea, and people have asked, well, how could Moderna literally within a couple days of America declaring COVID-19 a national emergency, how could Moderna, within a couple days, announce that they have clinical trials of their vaccine? I mean, if this was a brand new problem, it's impossible for a company to have a product, to have it fully ready for human testing within a couple days. It's, I can tell you, as a doctor, typically takes about 15 years to get to that step. Well, in fact, it did take 15 years because it was all being done in the years ahead of time. Again, in our book, we point out these key players. You know, billionaire CEO of Moderna, Stéphane Bancel, a French leader, he was the CEO of bioMérieux. That was the French company that was commissioned by Jacques Chirac to build the annex at the Wuhan Institute of Virology to build the biosafety level lab 4. That was Bancel. He leaves bioMérieux and joins a one-person company in Cambridge, Massachusetts called Moderna. Then he immediately starts working with the Chinese in the lab that he helped build to actually begin to develop the Moderna vaccine. This is, again, this is all in the open. This is well documented, not a controversy. There's no secret memos here. This is all in the published literature, now in the published nonfiction, literature as well. So this was all done ahead of time. So what we had is what was really in the short development was what was going to happen when we put it in humans. So this is what we found out in short cycle, that through the wild type and alpha